This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa idh qala Ibrahim Rabbi arini kayfa tuhyi al-mauta qala awalam tu'min qala bala walakin liyatma'inna qalbi قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. And when Abraham said, "My Lord, show me how you revive the dead," he said, "Do you not believe?" He said, "Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest." He said, "Take four of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them. They will come to you, hastening. And know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Day 22 of Israeli war on Gaza starts with relentless bombardment of the Strip, threats of expanding ground operations. The Hamas resistance movement says it is fully prepared to confront Israeli ground invasion into the besieged Gaza Strip. And the United Nations General Assembly approves a resolution calling for immediate humanitarian truce in Gaza. Hello everyone, and welcome to World News. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says it's foiled Israeli operations in two areas inside the Gaza Strip. In a statement, the Al-Qassam Brigade said it is confronting a ground incursion into Beit Hanun and east of Buraj in the northern and central parts of the Gaza Strip. A senior Hamas official also says that Israel is attempting to project an image of victory. The official, however, says resistance is putting up a heroic fight and the world will see the outcome until dawn. Israel announced an extension of ground operations in the besieged enclave late Friday. Strikes are being described as the fiercest since Israel began its onslaught on October 7th. The regime has cut communications and access to the internet across the Gaza Strip. Local officials say Israel is seeking to perpetuate a new massacre against Palestinians. For 3 weeks now, Palestinians in Gaza have been witnessing heartbreaking scenes of devastation and death caused by Israel's relentless air attacks. Every day and even every hour, they're pulling out dead bodies from under rubble, laying to rest women and children. Residents in the besieged strip are angry over the world's silence and inaction.
It's like the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima. There's no humanity left in the world. No one is standing by us. We haven't slept since yesterday and we haven't been able to pull anyone out from under the rubble. In this house, there were 70 to 80 people. Young children still remain under the rubble. What have these children done? Did they kill Israelis? They didn't kill anyone. They were just sitting safe in their homes and the whole residential block was brought down.
All those who lived here were innocent civilians. The airstrikes targeted our homes while we were inside them. Thank God we were able to emerge from under the rubble. God saved us, but there are no homes left, nothing here.
The UN General Assembly has overwhelmingly approved a resolution calling for humanitarian truce in the Gaza Strip. The non-binding resolution is demanding an immediate, durable, and sustained humanitarian truce. It also condemns all acts of violence against civilians as the death toll from Israeli onslaught tops 7,300, including thousands of women and children. A resolution proposed by Jordan was adopted with 120 votes in favor, 14 votes against, and 45 abstentions. Hamas resistance movement has welcomed the move. Israel, however, has claimed UN no longer holds any legitimacy. The United States, main supporter of the Israeli regime in this war, voted against the resolution. Meanwhile, Iran says support by the U.S. and the silence of a number of countries has emboldened the Israeli regime in intensification of attacks against civilians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. In a meeting with the UN chief in New York, Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian called on the world body and international community to take immediate and decisive action to end the genocide in Gaza. Amir Abdullahian warned that Israeli crimes could lead to the opening of new fronts against the regime. UN chief also described the current humanitarian situation in Gaza as catastrophic. Antonio Guterres urged all sides to enable immediate ceasefire and transfer of humanitarian aid into the coastal territory. Pro-Palestinian protesters once again marched throughout the world demanding an end to Israeli bloodshed in Gaza. One of the largest protests held in the U.S. city of New York so far, hundreds packed inside the city's Grand Central Terminal. They chanted, "No more weapons, no more war," and called on the U.S. to stop sending arms to Israel. In Turkey's Istanbul, protesters gathered at the iconic Taksim Square. They slammed the West for remaining silent on the Israeli attacks. Similar rallies are also held in Pakistan's Karachi, where people marched in solidarity with Palestinians and condemned Israel's attacks. Supporters of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement also took to the streets of the capital, Beirut, in support of Palestine and the Palestinian cause.
In response to a call by the Palestinian revolutionary factions, thousands of Syrians and Palestinians gathered in Jaramana refugee camp in Damascus to show their support for Gaza and the resistance front.
Today we reaffirm our right to return, determine our fate and establish our Palestinian state and our land with its capital in Al-Quds. We came today as civilians, but we confirm to the Zionist enemy that we can become fighters at any time.
Today we are sending a message to the entire world to see what is happening to our people in Palestine and the injustices they face, particularly women and children.
Protesters expressed their unwavering support for Gaza, pledging to lay down their lives in defense of Palestine and affirming that martyrdom is the only way to reclaim the right of liberating their land.
Today, amidst the challenging circumstances faced by Gaza, we observe a significant bias in Western media, which conceals the truth and events unfolding in Gaza, from Syria, a resilient nation, and from the Jarmana camp, in the heart of the capital Damascus. These people declare, "We, as Palestinians and Syrians, are brothers in blood and arms."
The crowds condemned the complicity of Western media in the heinous crimes committed by Israel against Palestinians and expressed their trust in the resistance media to reveal the truth.
While the Western media outlets turn a blind eye to over 2 million Palestinians trapped under daily Israeli bombing in Gaza, the Syrian people tell the world, "We believe in resistance and we will support Palestine until victory." Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Author and journalist Arnold August says the U.S. is losing the propaganda war and has huge crowds of people are turning out day by day in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
The United States is losing the propaganda war in the sense people no longer believe what the United States says with regard to so-called Hamas atrocities. You know, the demonstrations that are taking place in the Middle East, and other in Europe, in North America, Canada, United States, people are not at all intimidated by this narrative that that Hamas decapitated babies or any other so-called atrocities or so made-up atrocities. So this is an important turning point. I think one of the results of this is, as we speak today, there is something new since yesterday and today that apparently Qatar is trying to broker a ceasefire between the United States and Hamas, which would include the release of hostages to Israel. This is a major breakthrough. I mean, remember only a few days ago, Israel ordered all of its media, everyone had to say not to talk about a ceasefire. Ceasefire is off the table. And now, apparently, they are talking about a ceasefire. So this, if this is the case, I think it's a major turning point in this war, and it is definitely a victory for Hamas and the courageous Palestinian people. Despite all the attempts to stop them from resisting, they are continuing to resist and have increased the number of supporters around the world by millions and millions.
A conference dubbed Stop World War III has begun in Rome. event attended by former top officials, diplomats, and peace activists has taken place amid rising fears that the conflict in Ukraine and Israel's war on the besieged Gaza Strip could spread to more fronts and turn into a global war.
On Friday, a two-day conference dubbed Stop World War III kicked off in the Italian capital. Dozens of geopolitical analysts, delegates from peace movements and individuals took part in the event, which is aimed at discussing the root causes of the war between Russia and Ukraine and Israel's aggression on the Gaza Strip. Experts at the conference are saying the ongoing war in the Gaza Strip could possibly spill over to turn into a wider regional conflict and drag in more countries amid the Russia-Ukraine war and other geopolitical tensions across the globe. There are speculations that potential ripple effects of these conflicts could develop into a new world war. Conference speakers all agreed that the current wars have been triggered by the US and supported by its closest allies to maintain a unipolar world order, which is being called into question by billions of people across the globe.
We are in a historical transitional phase from a US-led decaying monopolar global order to a new one. Those representing the old order are wounded beasts, and wounded beasts are extremely dangerous.
Regarding the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war, some analysts and top officials pointed out that the conflict did not start neither on February 24 last year, nor when the US incited the 2014 coup, but farther back in time with the expansion of NATO towards Eastern Europe.
The NATO in the present form is the most source of war danger in Europe and in the world. And that's why NATO not only should stop expansion, but NATO should stop its existence.
Israel is a supremacist, racist, warmongering, and colonialist state. This state does not represent the Jewish community as a whole. There is a deep split in it, as many Jews are against Zionism.
On Friday, the United Nations urged Israel to put an end to its collective punishment of the entire population of the Gaza Strip, noting that collective punishment is a war crime. Max Civili, Rome.
The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has hit at least 6 military targets in Israeli-occupied territories. Hezbollah said it struck the targets, including in a Misgab Am Kibbutz, with precision-guided missiles. The group said sites in Kafr Shuba and Shabwa Farms region were also hit. The statement added that some technical capabilities of the Israeli facilities were destroyed. This came after Israel carried out attacks on southern Lebanon. Areas witnessed exchanges of fire since the 8th of October. That was the day after major Palestinian operation against Israel. There have been several casualties on both sides. As the Israeli regime continues its genocidal campaign against Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip, attempts to silence voices in support of the arrests of oppressed people have also intensified. Reports have been circulating at an alarming pace about activists being sacked from their positions, journalists relieved of their duties, and even athletes stripped of their contracts.
Since October the 7th, Israel has launched a relentless bombing campaign against the people of Gaza. The bombardments have claimed the lives of thousands of innocent Palestinians, most of them women and children. Israel's genocidal war on the people of Palestine has sparked mass rallies across the world. Journalists, activists, and even athletes have joined the growing calls to put an end to the carnage. But most of these voices are being suppressed due to the pressure by Israel and Zionist lobbies. Reports have been circulating at an alarming pace about activists being sacked from their positions, journalists being relieved of their duties, and even athletes being stripped of their contracts. The editor-in-chief of an academic journal said that he was fired from his job after sharing an article about people dying in Gaza. Michael Eisen, a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley, and the editor of the scientific journal eLife, tweeted to say that he had been informed that he is being replaced as the publication's editor. Egyptian TikToker Karim Kabani said he had been sacked sacked from his job in France because he made three videos on TikTok in support of the people of Palestine. Jackson Frank, who was recently appointed as the Sixers beat writer for Philly Voice, was relieved of his duties after sending out a tweet in solidarity with the people of Palestine. Frank, a vocal supporter of Palestine, in one of his tweets days after his unceremonious sacking, termed the Israeli atrocities against the people in Gaza as, quote, genocide. In the Canadian city of Ontario, the New Democratic Party, NDP, expelled MPP Sarah Jama from the caucus earlier this week for her statements in support of Palestinians.
Governments and institutions in Canada are trying to use their voice to wait to silence us, to silence workers, students, educators, and peace-loving people who dare to support Palestine. And to every person who's taking a risk to speak up for Palestinian dignity and safety, I see you and I hear you and I am with you. They try hard to silence us, but we know that our words are powerful and we must continue to speak up no matter the cost.
In a series of tweets, Sarah Jama called for an immediate ceasefire and de-escalation. Maha Dakhil, one of the top agents in Hollywood, also had to call it quits from her role at the Creative Artists Agency, CAA, after she posted in support of Palestine. And Tanya Singh, a unionist from Minneapolis, said she had been terminated from her job in a union for anti-Semitism over her support for Palestine.
Governments across the world, in an attempt to address anti-Semitism and somehow redress the horrors of the Holocaust, are allowing Israel to get away with apartheid, ethnic cleansing, detention of children, torture, restriction of movement and other freedoms, and the illegal occupation of land. After every genocide, the world cries out, "Never again!" And yet here you see another attempted genocide unfold right in front of your eyes, and you don't just watch on quietly, but actively supporting the oppressor.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan has broken ranks with his party's leadership to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. They made the call during a video posted on social media. Khan warned that widespread Israeli military escalation will only deepen the humanitarian disaster, adding the regime does not have the right to break international law. Scottish Labour leader, as well as hundreds of the party's councillors and nearly a quarter of MPs, will also call for immediate cessation of violence. This mounts pressure on Labour leader Keir Starmer. He and the ruling Conservative Party leader Rishi Sunak have so far resisted calls for a total ceasefire. Starmer is also facing criticism by many voters across the country since appearing to give his support to Israel, cutting off water, fuel, energy, and food supplies into Gaza. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
In the limelight.
French President Emmanuel Macron traveled to Tel Aviv to express his country's full solidarity with the child killer regime of Israel in the wake of the Zionist regime's atrocious military campaign against the Gaza Strip. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote, as if the visit to occupied Palestine by the three murderous musketeers, Joe Biden of the U.S., Olaf Scholz of Germany, and Rishi Sunak of the U.K., to cheer the genocide in Gaza was not enough. The miscreant Emmanuel Macron of France, posing as the dastardly D'Artagnan, dashed to the illegal Zionist entity to goad the cowardly mass killer Benjamin Netanyahu to massacre without any mercy the defenseless people of the long-besieged sliver. The French president, who is a notorious Islamophobe, now wants to show that he is an enemy of the Christians as well, since his unwarranted visit coincided with the Zionist regime's bombing of churches and church-run hospitals in Gaza. Oh. All these four thugs, Joe Biden, Olaf Scholz, Rishi Sunak and Emmanuel Macron, as well as other terroristic leaders of countries that have shamelessly expressed support for the Zionist regime crimes against humanity, are also war criminals, with the blood of the innocent on their hides heads. The Palestinians are struggling against occupation. They have not occupied anybody's land. Those Zionists killed during the heroic Al-Aqsa storm operation were not just occupiers from Europe and other places, but armed thugs with the blood of many an innocent Palestinian on their head. Rest assured, the Palestinians are the ultimate victors. According to the Middle East Eye, Western capitals know exactly how much the Palestinians of Gaza have been provoked, because those same governments have been complicit for decades in supporting the Zionist regime, as it has ethnically cleansed Palestinians from their homeland and imprisoned the remnants of the population in ghettos across their homeland. For the past 16 years, Western backing for the Zionist regime has not wavered, even as the Zionist regime has turned the coastal enclave of Gaza from the world's largest open-air prison into a gruesome torture chamber where Palestinians are experimented on. Their food and power have been rationed, essentials of life denied to them, their access to drinkable water slowly removed, and their hospitals prevented from receiving medical supplies and equipment. The West is no less responsible now as the Zionist regime steps up its barbaric treatment of Gaza. The Zionist regime war minister, Yoav Gallant, decided to deepen the siege on Gaza recently by stopping all food and power, a crime against humanity. He has referred to the enclave's caged Palestinian population, including men, women and children, as human animals. Dehumanization, as history has proved time and again, is the prelude to ever greater outrages and horrors. Meanwhile, Press TV reported medical authorities in the Gaza Strip say at least 140 Palestinians have lost their lives and more sustained injuries when the Zionist regime aircraft carried out a round of airstrikes recently. The officials stated that the new Israeli regime airstrikes targeted Al-Shati refugee camp in the northern Gaza Strip, as well as the southern cities of Rafah and Khan Yunis, among others. The official Palestinian news agency Wafa reported that the Zionist regime warplanes destroyed a residential building belonging to the Al-Aidi family in Rafah, killing 48 individuals and injuring dozens more. Another house was also reduced to rubble in Tal al-Sultan neighborhood of Rafah, leaving several civilians dead and injured. The Zionist regime warplanes bombed an inhabited house in Beit Lahia, killing and wounding several people. The injured victims were transferred to the Indonesian hospital in the city to receive medical treatment. Moreover, a number of civilians were killed and injured when the Zionist regime aircraft pounded the Al-Fallujah area, located 30 kilometers northeast of Gaza City. The Zionist regime jets also hit a house in the city of Khan Yunis, causing several casualties who were taken to Nasser Hospital in the city. The aircraft bombed another house in the same city as well, killing and wounding several people. An Israeli regime air raid also targeted a house in the Boreji refugee camp in the central Gaza Strip, killing and wounding a number of people, including women and children. This comes as hospitals in Gaza are still being bombed by the Zionist regime and the healthcare system is at risk of collapse if no medical equipment and supplies are provided. According to Wafa News Agency, the Indonesian hospital in Beit Lahia has been partially without electricity since last night, October 24th, as a result of the exhaustion of fuel needed to operate its electric generators. Doctors in the hospital warned of disastrous consequences in case the generators stop working completely, as hundreds of injured people are receiving treatment there and some are connected to ventilators in order to survive. Meanwhile, French President Emmanuel Macron has traveled to Tel Aviv to express his country's full solidarity with the child killer regime of Israel in the wake of the Zionist regime's atrocious military campaign against the Gaza Strip. He said upon arrival in the 1948 Israeli-occupied territories, "We, France, stand shoulder to shoulder with you, Israel."
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
September 1978, U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who was really concerned about peace and security in the world, invited the two sides of a major conflict to a meeting. His guests were Anwar al-Sadat, President of Egypt, and former fighter and the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin. After 30 years of fruitless Arab-Israeli wars, both sides preferred to talk secretly about the conflict for a few days. The secret talks needed a comfortable place, and it was situated in Washington Northwest Road on top of the forested hills. It was Camp David, the country retreat for the President of the United States. It is a place filled with trees, good weather, and also important secrets. Of course, this was not the first time that the United States held itself accountable for Israel. Jimmy Carter was not the only one who had this sense of responsibility in U.S. government. The first and perhaps most responsible U.S. president on the Palestinian issue was Harry S. Truman. The most important place to express this sense of responsibility was in the United Nations General Assembly to divide Palestine into two independent states, Arab and Jewish. it was possible to create a nation with the vote of the majority and give them land in the same place.
Those who are in favor will say yes, those who are against will say no.
Afghanistan, no. Argentina, Argentina, abstention. Egypt, no. Iraq, no. Lebanon, no. Soviet Union, yes.
United Kingdom, abstain. United States, yes. Paraguay, yes.
The resolution of the Duck Committee for Palestine was adopted by 33 votes, 13 against, 10 abstentions.
Israeli flag was hoisted outside the United Nations just after this session. When the UN General Assembly voted on the partition plan for Palestine, the Zionists did not keep the great powers waiting. The representative of the Jewish agency at the UN told the members of the Security Council what they were waiting for.
Not later than May 16th next, a provisional Jewish government will commence to function in cooperation with the representatives of the United Nations then in Palestine.
But in the first step, the White House acted against the Zionist expectations.
America.
The U.S. State Department argued against it. Their first response was, no country, no state.
No mandate, no Medina.
The situation was not good at all, so the Prime Minister of Israel, Moshe Sharet, was sent to the United States so that he might be able to change the strong-willed United States Secretary of State's opinion on the recognition of the State of Israel. But George Marshall did not agree at all. Marshall went to the White House to talk to Harry S. Truman, and he realized that the president did not agree with him and had different ideas about Israel. Clark Clifford, the White House counsel, was also present in that meeting.
General Marshall started off. The president listened attentively and then said, I would like now to hear from Clark. But as I spoke, I saw Marshall's face getting redder and redder.
George Marshall realized that Truman supported Israel for two reasons: Zionist money and votes in the upcoming elections. And Truman mentioned this point explicitly. However, Marshall tried to make Truman aware of the consequences of his decision.
We are in the midst of a very critical situation. We should therefore carefully avoid approaching international problems on an emotional basis.
Finally, Marshall said that if Truman recognized the Israeli interim government, he would not support his candidacy in the upcoming elections. But 2 days later, on May 14, 1948, the leaders of the Jewish National Council went to this building, the Tel Aviv Museum, to proclaim the establishment of an independent Jewish state. Shortly before this announcement, Eliyahu Epstein, head of the Jewish agency in Washington, wrote to the U.S. president that the Act of Independence would become effective at 1 minute after 6 p.m. on May 14, 1948, Washington time. With full knowledge of the deep bond of sympathy which has existed and has been strengthened over the past 30 years between the government of the United States and the Jewish people of Palestine, I have been authorized by the provisional government of the new state to tender this message and to express the hope that your government will recognize and will welcome Israel into the community of nations. hours later, just 11 minutes past 6 p.m., Harry Truman wrote to the UN General Assembly despite George Marshall's disagreements.
This government has been informed that a Jewish state has been proclaimed in Palestine and recognition has been requested by the provisional government thereof. The United States recognizes the provisional government as the de facto authority of the new state of Israel.
The Israeli happiness of forming a Jewish homeland on the promised land did not last long. The very next day, when David Ben-Gurion read the Declaration of Independence at the Tel Aviv Museum, Egypt, Jordan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria, angry with their new uninvited neighbor, attacked Israel. The fledgling Israel had no aircraft nor tanks, and the Arabs were superior against the Zionists in the number of fighters and arms, and their victory seemed certain. The same theory turned into reality, and the Arabs achieved significant victories. The Zionists saw with their own eyes that the Jewish homeland was on the edge of destruction. David Ben-Gurion and his companions had to do something, so they went around the world to buy weapons. Finally, Czechoslovakia and Russia sold arms to Israel. The weapons of the Eastern Bloc changed the equation of power on the battlefield. Arabs were optimistic and participated with part of their power in the war, but they were unsuccessful. The UN was under the US pressure to declare a ceasefire to end the Arab-Israeli conflict and pressured the Arabs to sign a ceasefire agreement with Israel. After 9 months of fighting in vain, the ceasefire put an end to the conflict. The Arabs did not accept the peace agreement with Israel because peace meant the recognition of the State of Israel. The Arabs accepted the ceasefire, not peace. The next Arab-Israeli dispute was over a waterway built in 1869 in Egypt. This canal connected Port Said on the Mediterranean coast to the Gulf of Suez in the Red Sea. This waterway later became known as the Suez Canal. The canal was built so that ships traveling from the west to the ports of the east of the world would not have to go around the African continent. The Suez Canal Company was owned by Britain for many years, but the new Egyptian president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, gave a fervent speech on July 26, 1956, in Alexandria, announcing the nationalization of the Suez Canal Company. Then he raised the flag of his country in that region as the sign of this nationalization. All assets of Suez International Company, most of which belonged to Britain and France, were frozen. The French, who resented the Egyptian aid to the Algerian revolutionaries, in addition to the Suez affair, held a secret meeting in Paris with the British, who had been deprived of the huge Suez Canal shipping revenue. This top-secret meeting had a very special guest, Israeli representative Shimon Peres. The French and British believed that they had to inveigle Israel into invading Egypt in order to take revenge on Gamal Abdel Nasser. They knew that Nasser banned Israeli ships and planes from passing through the Strait of Tiran a year earlier in 1955, and this act could have provoked Israel to attack Egypt. Their ideas attracted Peres's attention, and he soon returned to Israel to inform David Ben-Gurion of their secret offer. Ben-Gurion began working on the plan and was sure that it could alleviate the situation. Nasser predicted the war and asked the United States to buy weapons. But Washington refused it because of the 1950 tripartite agreement on the Middle East among the US, France, and Britain. The agreement banned selling arms to countries in the region to prevent an arms race. So Gamal Abdel Nasser reached out to the Soviet Union for economic and military assistance. Czechoslovakia agreed to give arms to Egypt. The proximity of Egypt and the Eastern Bloc could have intensified the Cold War. On October the 29th, 1956, the Israelis invaded the Sinai Desert. A week later, they occupied it. French fighter jets also provided security for Israeli ground forces in Sinai against the powerful Egyptian Air Force. Israel ignored the importance of power. The United States, which was furious with Israel over its alliance with France and Britain, repeatedly pressured the United Nations Security Council to do something about a temporary ceasefire. On October the 13th, the UN Security Council convened and voted on a draft resolution urging Israel to withdraw its forces to establish a temporary ceasefire. But the resolution was vetoed by France and Britain, and the Soviet Union proposed a similar resolution that had no better fate than the previous one. Dwight D. Eisenhower, then President of the United States, appeared on camera and spoke on behalf of his nation.
The United States was not consulted in any way about any phase of these actions, nor were we informed of them in advance. In the circumstances I have described, there will be no United States involvement in these present hostilities. I therefore have no plan to call the Congress in special session. Of course, we shall continue to keep in contact with congressional leaders of both parties. It is our hope and intent that this matter will be brought before the United Nations General Assembly. There, with no veto operating, the opinion of the world can be brought to bear in our quest for a just end to this tormenting problem. In the past, the United Nations has proved able to find a way to end bloodshed. We believe it can and that it will do so again.
The dispute between the permanent members of the Security Council over the ceasefire was not resolved, and as a result, the UN General Assembly convened a special emergency meeting at the request of the Security Council and issued the ceasefire order by 57 votes. But France and Britain ignored the decree. When Nikolai Bulganin, the Soviet Prime Minister, noted the situation of his communist ally, issued an ultimatum to France and Britain to destroy London and Paris with atomic bombs if they did not stop invading Egypt. The next day, the military offensive against Egypt ceased. On November the 14th, the first UN peacekeeping troops were deployed in the area, so the Israeli forces left Sinai. The UN flag established a 10-year ceasefire between Egypt and Israel. This fruitless retreat benefited Abdel Nasser more than anyone else. Nasser was about to become an irreplaceable hero of Arab dreams. In May 1967, when Egyptian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Anwar al-Sadat went to Moscow to meet the Soviet Prime Minister, Alexei Kosygin, he was secretly told that Israel had gathered all its forces on the Syrian border.
Anwar al-Sadat was asked to inform Abdel Nasser, the man who became the hero of the Arabs by nationalizing the Suez Canal. This mischievous news from the Russians was in fact a kind of incitement to provoke Egypt to attack Israel. The Soviet Union liked to witness a war in the Middle East, so the power in East and West would be in favor of the communists.
We believed a war could bring us political gains. Even a stalemate could bring us benefits. Egypt had our backing, both political and military. We thought their forces would demonstrate the benefits of Soviet support. So we were confident that the balance of power in the Middle East would be altered by a localized war.
The Egyptian army did not report any movements on the Syrian-Israeli border, but the Russians again confirmed the news. In any case, Nasser did not take the risk and ordered his defense minister, Abdel Hakim Amer, to be ready to attack Israel if Israel invaded Syria. Russia's plan to start a war in the Middle East was turning into reality. Abdel Nasser wrote a letter to the United Nations calling for the withdrawal of peacekeeper troops stationed on the Israeli-Egyptian border since the nationalization of the Suez Canal so that the Egyptian army could take stand. This measure drew all the attention to Sharm el-Sheikh port in Sinai. Egypt took the initiative and closed the Strait of Tiran in the Gulf of Aqaba again. By doing so, the Zionists' water connection with the east of the world was completely cut off. Egypt blocked the only way for Israeli oil transfer, and that meant the declaration of war.
Our armed forces are ready for war. The Gulf of Aqaba belongs to Egypt. There is no way that we will allow Israeli ships to pass through. The Jews are threatening war. We tell them hello and welcome. We are ready for war. But there is no way we will give up our rights to the Gulf of Aqaba.
In the limelight.
The list of hospitals and other public facilities bombed by American forces, as well as their British counterparts, is quite long. Zionists have followed the same model to instill fear in Palestinians. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, on the eve of U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the occupied Palestinian territories, the Zionist regime's warplanes raided a hospital in the besieged Gaza Strip, killing at least 700 people, mostly children and women. The exact death toll in a devastating strike on Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in Gaza is not known yet, with some reports putting it at more than 1,000. It was a massacre, according to eyewitnesses. Despite attempts by the Zionist regime to shift the blame on the Gaza-based Palestinian resistance groups, in that order, evidence suggests that it was the Zionist regime's handiwork. Hamas said the attack mostly killed internally displaced people who had taken refuge at a hospital, considering it safe amid the indiscriminate Zionist regime aerial blitz that has so far claimed the lives of 3,300 people in the Gaza Strip. The fact that the hospital bombing came hours before Biden landed at the Tel Aviv airport is telling. Biden has unequivocally defended the Zionist regime's ongoing genocide in the coastal Gaza Strip, even amplifying unsubstantiated claims that were denied by the Zionist regime officials themselves. He said he had seen the video in which the Zionist regime children were beheaded by Hamas resistance fighters, parroting the lie that was started by an Israeli regime journalist and later repeated by the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's spokesman on a live show broadcast by CNN News Network. The claim eventually proved to be a big lie, but the American president did not bother to offer an apology. At a joint press conference with Netanyahu in Tel Aviv recently, Biden said Washington would provide the embattled regime with everything it needed to defend itself, while repeating another crude Israeli lie that the hospital attack was caused by a misfired rocket by Palestine. U.S. President likened the Hamas resistance group to Daesh and described the group's Al-Aqsa Storm operation in the wee hours of Saturday morning, October 7th, as a slaughter. Biden told Netanyahu, giving him a clean sheet, "Based on what I have seen, it appears as though it was not you. But there is a lot of people out there not sure, so we've got to overcome a lot of things." Biden's unfounded assertions came after the Zionist regime's military spokesperson Daniel Hagari showed imagery and asserted that the propellant from the rocket had ignited and caused the explosion. The fact that Netanyahu ordered the deadly strike hours before Biden's arrival and eventually got the clean sheet from the U.S. president shows the war crime was carried out with Washington's backing. The bombing of hospitals and other civilian facilities is not an alien concept for American warmongers themselves. They have done it in multiple countries, including Afghanistan and Iraq, for decades. The anniversary of the bombing of Kunduz Trauma Center in northern Afghanistan's Kunduz province on October 3, 2015, including its intensive care unit, emergency rooms, labs, X-ray unit, outpatient department, mental health, and physiotherapy ward, was observed just 2 weeks ago. At least 42 people, including patients, staff, and caretakers, were killed in the devastating attack carried out by an American gunship, which marked one of the deadliest chapters in the 20-year-long war. The hospital was operated by Doctors Without Borders, and the only thing Americans did was to apologize to MSF. The victims and their families were never provided justice. According to eyewitnesses, the U.S. AC-130 Hercules gunship fired 211 shells on the main hospital building where Afghan patients were sleeping in their beds or were being operated on the operation theater. The then U.S. commander in Afghanistan, John F. Campbell, later admitted that the hospital was mistakenly struck without a shred of remorse and without any promise of justice and accountability. Americans destroyed hospitals in Iraq as well during years of military occupation of the country. In April 2003, U.S. aircraft pounded a Red Crescent maternity hospital in Baghdad, killing several people. The 56-bedroom Al-Mansur Hospital was the first IRCS health facility in the war-torn country. The list of hospitals and other public facilities bombed by American forces, as well as their British counterparts, is quite long. Zionists have followed the same model to instill fear in Palestinians. However, these formulas are bound to fail. They failed in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now they are failing in Palestine. The hospital bombing recently has only galvanized the Palestinian resistance. It has also exposed the deep alliance between Zionists and Americans and how they have backed each other's horrendous war crimes for years, including the bombardment of hospitals and killing of civilians. The international law is clear on hospital bombings. The Fourth Geneva Convention on the Protection of Civilian Persons During War prohibits the targeting of civilians, especially in schools and hospitals. But as we all know, international law does not apply to lawless entities. According to Wafa News Agency, the Palestinian Ministry of Health has said on October 24th the death toll from the ongoing Israeli occupation forces' aggression against the Gaza Strip and the West Bank since October 7th has risen to more than 5,795 dead. 5,700 in the Gaza Strip, 95 in the West Bank, and about 18,000 wounded, 16,000 in the Gaza Strip and 1,836 in the West Bank.